Hi, it's Dave. In this video, I enlist the help of Anthony Pompliano, also known as Pomp, to help me think through some of the long-term concerns and risks I see for Bitcoin. A couple weeks ago, I asked my Twitter followers for some help in identifying someone who could help me think through some of the long-term risks I see for Bitcoin. Overwhelmingly, the number one person that was suggested was Pomp. He runs a top 10 business and finance podcast called the Pomp Podcast and is one of the forefront thinkers and advocates on Bitcoin. I hope you enjoyed the conversation.
Hey, Pomp,
how's it going?
Doing fantastic. How are you?
Great. Hey, thanks so much for taking the time out.
Absolutely. Where are you in the world?
Near San Diego, down in Southern California. Okay. How about yourself?
New York City.
New York City. Okay. Cool. Yeah, I wanted to thank you first. Taking the time out to chat. I know. You are so generous because a lot of my followers have been saying that I need to talk with you. You're the man I need to talk with. I've shared some tweets about how I have some doubts about Bitcoin's long-term future, and so I wanted to discuss it with you. And so I figure, if you don't mind, I'll take a few minutes to kind of share my kind of overall kind of general view of Bitcoin and crypto.
Let's do it.
And then I have three main concerns regarding, you know, Bitcoin especially. So overall, I'm actually not necessarily bearish completely on Bitcoin over the next 5 to 10 years. I understand a lot of the Bitcoin, you know, bull arguments. I actually agree to a large extent that there's a lot of, you know, short-term or near-term and mid-term type of scenarios and forces that make Bitcoin appealing in a lot of ways. You have, you know, the central banks printing all this money. You have, you know, people worried about inflation, you know, needing a hedge. You have Bitcoin as the leading cryptocurrency. And you also have a lot of demand coming up. You know, you have a lot of even companies who are storing, you know, their extra reserve funds in Bitcoin. And so the whole general public attitude toward Bitcoin has radically changed in the past 2 or 3 years. And so I'm not one to, you know, basically look down at Bitcoin's potential over the next 5 to 10 years. Like, I actually see, you know, the potential. And the other thing about Bitcoin is I'm actually very, very interested on a more philosophical / historical level, where I think one of the biggest risks and trends in the future is this theme of government overreach and kind of our personal liberties being at stake, especially with the rise of tech and AI empowering governments even more. And so Bitcoin is just such a fascinating angle, you know, to kind of somewhat have potential to counter that and provide almost an alternative, not just financial system, but more than that even. And so in some ways, like, I'm intrigued by Bitcoin because I see more than just a profit potential. I see this is something that's like, you know, it doesn't come around that often. This is like once in a lifetime, once in a generational type of occurrence. And I think it's essential for people to understand what's going on. You know, this isn't, I mean, most people look at crypto as like a trading opportunity, you know, they go, oh, it's going to go up and down. But for me, there's something more substantial going on here that I think needs to be uncovered and we need to take a deeper look. And so I've been thinking about this a lot out of respect for Bitcoin and crypto. But I'm having a hard time finding people or a person who can answer some of my kind of deepest kind of doubts or questions. So that's kind of the context of where I'm coming from. Hope that helps a bit.
Let's try. I don't know if I can answer all your questions, but I'll do my best.
All right, sounds good. So the first kind of major set of doubts or concerns I have for Bitcoin is around government and government kind of control, crackdown of Bitcoin and cryptos. So here's my take. I think over the next few years, 5 years, probably 10 years, I'm not too concerned because I don't think Bitcoin poses enough threat to the government right now for the government really to be motivated and to all be unified to come against Bitcoin or crypto right now. However, when I look 10 to 20 years down the road and I see Bitcoin and crypto, actually, let's say it just continues to grow and reaches some type of tipping point of mass adoption, I could see a point where the government gets threatened by Bitcoin and crypto because of tax evasion and the inability of governments to track all basically transactions. And the way I look at it, 10 years down the road, 15 years down the road, we have the elimination of cash. So cash is gone from the system. The government is loaded with debt and they feel a lot of pressure to increase taxes on their citizens to survive. So it's existential, like the ability for governments to raise taxes is at the central of their existence. And with that scenario, the government's going to do more and more things to try to track financial transactions and to tax, you know, everything that they can do. And in that scenario, I think the government is just going to feel pressured, but also feel empowered by all this technology, the use of AI, et cetera, to monitor and surveil their citizens, that they're going to establish their own cryptocurrency. And by establishing their own cryptocurrency, they're going to be able to maximize tax revenue out of its citizens. And with their own cryptocurrency, the next logical step is to ban all other cryptos that don't have transparency. That, in other words, the government won't be able to fully tax every transaction that they can. And so for me, in some ways, this scenario is almost inevitable in 10 or 15 or 20 years, let's say hypothetically, with, you know, the government's kind of routes, you know, their need to tax and the ability for governments to bring a crypto, you know, to market is, I don't think it's going to be that hard. What's your kind of general take? How can you help me understand this angle?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of things in there. First, let's just start with kind of where Bitcoin is today, right? So it's about a $275 billion asset, as you alluded to. That is like not even on the radar in the global financial system, right? You know, gold is $8 trillion, $9 trillion. The global money supply is somewhere in the $80, $90 trillion mark. So Bitcoin's not even one yet, right? And $1 trillion. And so it could literally go up about 4x and just barely breach that. And so I think that, like, you're dead on in terms of it's still just such a small market cap asset. The second part of this is, you know, one of the misconceptions about Bitcoin is this lack of transparency or kind of anonymous transactions, right? So if you actually think of what a blockchain is, or the Bitcoin blockchain, it is a transparent ledger of all the transactions, right? So if you think about transparency in two fronts. One is through the transactions, and then the other is through monetary policy. With Bitcoin, I can go back to January 3rd, 2009, and I can show you every single transaction that has ever occurred on the Bitcoin blockchain, right? And now the wallets don't have Dave's name on it or Anthony's name on it, right? They have kind of this Bitcoin wallet address, so there's a pseudonymity to it, mm-hmm. but you can track every single one. And so if you think about, let's say first, like the most nefarious actors in the world, you know, like the actual money launderers, drug dealers, you know, murderers, terrorist organizations, et cetera, Bitcoin's actually like a really, really bad currency to use, right? You're better off like literally going and putting your money through Wells Fargo, right? Because they've shown that like they'll just let it go right through, not have a huge problem. Or to use physical cash, right? I think that there's a lot of studies out there that show about $2 trillion of US dollars end up getting laundered every year through kind of the traditional system. And so when you look at it from like pure most nefarious criminals in the world, of course, law enforcement is going to step in and say, hey, we don't want you using Bitcoin to do bad things, just like we don't want dollars, right? But they have extra tools in their toolbox when it comes to those public transactions with Bitcoin. Now, obviously, Bitcoin is built around this idea of sovereignty and kind of privacy and you know, very much the kind of individualistic ethos. And so the idea that the government can see every single transaction does not make a lot of Bitcoiners super excited, right? They kind of worry about surveillance state and things like that. And so when you think about it from a privacy technology standpoint, what I think you're going to see is you're going to continue to see the cat and mouse game that you see in the legacy world, right? The government gets better technology to surveil better, right? The privacy technology gets better. And you kind of get this race and they ratchet each other up over time. And it really is kind of a balance between privacy and kind of that you know, national security type state, law enforcement state. Now, when you talk specifically about taxes, I think that, you know, right now as we stand today, and this can change, but as we stand today, Bitcoin is taxed just like any other asset, right? So the way that the rules are written, it's actually worse to use Bitcoin to buy something than a traditional dollar, right? So if you go and you spend Bitcoin, that is a taxable event. There's a lot of people working within kind of the government confines, either as elected officials or kind of lobbyists and stuff like that, to get like a de minimis exemption. So, you know, hey, if I spend $500 or less or $1,000 or less, I shouldn't have to pay taxes every time I use this as a currency, right? But as of today, that is a taxable event. And so actually the government makes more money taxing people who spend Bitcoin than they do spending the dollar. Now, that will likely change over time, right? I got kind of confidence that we'll get some sort of de minimis exemption, and you'll be able to use this to buy goods and services. Now, the part that becomes really, really interesting that you brought up is this idea of like a digital dollar, right? Or kind of a US-backed cryptocurrency. I've been saying now for quite a while that, one, I believe that the United States should immediately go digitize the dollar, right? And kind of create their own cryptocurrency. It wouldn't really be a cryptocurrency because it's not decentralized, but their own version of this digital currency. The reason why I bring that up is because ultimately where I think we're headed is that every currency in the world is going to be digitized. And when I say every currency, there's three buckets of currencies. There's the state-backed currencies, so the dollar, the yuan, the euro, the yen, you know, all the way down the line. There's then what I'll call kind of private corporation currencies. So this is like Facebook's Libra. This is JPM coin, right? A bunch of these people. Usually those are some digital currency that is backed by or pegged to a fiat currency or a commodity. And then there are the decentralized versions, right? And so obviously Bitcoin is pretty much the one there. And so when you think about everything being digitized, the reason why governments have to digitize their currency is because it's a game theory. It's a global game theory, right? Right now, China has a digital currency that they have created. If I'm anywhere in the world and my currency starts to fail, I have worries about any sort of thing with my home currency, and I want to get out of that currency, I could buy gold, but usually it's hard to get the gold. I got to carry it around. I can't really buy stuff in gold, all that kind of stuff. I actually want dollars, right? I don't want Bitcoin. I want dollars. Dollars are stable. They've got the backing of the US government, right, in terms of kind of the full faith and credit in that whole storyline. It feels safe. You know, the person on the street will take the dollars, all that kind of stuff. It's usually dangerous to get the dollars, right? The black market can be a huge ripoff. And also in certain countries like a Zimbabwe, a Venezuela, Iran, et cetera, I'm worried that the bank could seize it or the government could seize my dollars if I leave it in my bank account. And so what ends up happening is you say, look, if it's so hard to go get dollars, what currency can I get just with an internet connection? Historically, that's only been really Bitcoin, right? And so you got all the problems in terms of using it as a day-to-day currency today in terms of price volatility and all of that. Now, if all of a sudden there is centralized digital Chinese currency, and I can get access to that currency, but I can't get access to a digital dollar, well, I'm going to use the Chinese currency, right? So it becomes an accessibility thing. And so what I think is going to end up happening is China is going to continue to drive adoption inside of China of this digital currency, and then they're really going to push for global adoption, right? This is their way to kind of get out in front of everybody and drive global adoption of their currency before the U.S. does it. Now, the U.S. obviously is not going to sit around and just let this happen, right? I think the U.S. has already talked about a digital dollar. They're looking at it. The Federal Reserve's talked about it, all that. I do think that we will create a digital dollar. What that is going to do, though, is going to create a very unique environment where in that environment, you're going to force the adoption of digital wallets. So if now all of a sudden you have a digital dollar, people get paid in the digital dollar, they pay their taxes in the digital dollar, right? So you need a digital wallet. Well, if every currency is digitized, there's no longer a competition at the technology layer, right? Everything is digitized. The competition now between all these currencies comes to the monetary policy level. And if you actually look at the US, China, Europe, et cetera, all of these currencies historically have competed on quantitative easing, interest rates, you know, kind of these micro levels that each central bank can pull. But from a macro level, they're all the same. They're all fiat inflationary currencies, right? Bitcoin comes along. Bitcoin is a complete divergence from that. It's actually a 180-degree difference, right? It is backed by computing power. It's deflationary. It's fully transparent and all this stuff. And so what I think ends up happening is you're going to see once every currency is digitized, the flow of capital will go from like the soft currencies to the hard currencies, right? And Bitcoin having kind of the superior monetary policy. Now, when that starts to happen, to your point, governments are going to say, wait a second. We've basically accelerated the adoption of digital wallets. We've accelerated the adoption of digital currencies, but now all the value is being sucked up into kind of this sound money or hard money currency that Bitcoin is, right? Kind of the digital application of sound money. When that occurs, I think that governments are going to go through kind of an exercise. They have two options. They can either do nothing, right? And basically not try to ban it or they could try to embrace it or whatever, or they could try to ban it. The countries that choose to clamp down are the ones that are going to suffer the most. Because the one thing that Bitcoin has at its core that is the advantage is it's fully decentralized. So let's say the U.S. literally said, we're going to ban ownership. Everyone in the United States is not allowed to own Bitcoin. They did it with gold previously, right? And if you own Bitcoin, then we're going to put you in jail. We're going to do whatever. I think that what you would see is immediately other global superpowers immediately embrace and adopt Bitcoin because it is their opportunity to get off the dollar standard. They want off the dollar, right? Russia and Putin have talked about this. China has talked about this. Many countries think it's expensive. It's dangerous. You can be sanctioned. You know, all the things that the U.S. uses as an advantage by weaponizing the dollar globally, that's been great because they control the dollar and they've got a really big military, right? The most powerful military in the world. When we get into a world where all of a sudden the U.S. openly states we are going to ban ownership of something, and these other countries have full accessibility to it, I think that there's this game of they're going to go try to do it. And so for that reason, I actually think the U.S. will never ban it, right? I think the U.S. is not naive. They understand that, hey, there is going to be this global currency. And so, you know, in the conversations I've had with elected officials and things like that, I've actually said, look, do the opposite. You should be the one leading. You should go and try to petition to let's get Bitcoin into the Federal Reserve. Right. Let's actually put it and use it as our central bank reserves or some portion of them. Let's embrace this. How do we figure this out? And I think where you're seeing that kind of take hold is last year, I think it was when they were doing the Facebook Libra hearings. Right. And they kind of were bringing David Marcus and folks in front of these elected officials. Multiple congressmen stood up on the Senate floor or the Congress floor and said things like you cannot stop Bitcoin and therefore we should not try. Right. Or said things like, I believe Bitcoin will continue to accrue value in the future, or it will continue to only gain momentum. And so I think that there's a lot of people inside of our country, whether they're elected officials, whether they're appointed positions, whether they're, large asset managers or just retail, kind of private citizens. They're all seeing the writing on the wall. And what it ultimately comes back to is that idea of digitizing the dollar. I'm always very careful to remind people that doesn't change the monetary policy of the dollar. So you don't actually take away your problems with the monetary policy. What you do is you change the technology form factor. And yes, could it potentially lead to a more surveillance-based state, right? Kind of what you're talking about, the ability to now see every transaction somebody's doing, be able to tax them, all that kind of stuff. To me, that is not solving the monetary policy problem, which is kind of strike one. And then strike two is actually pushing us closer to a surveillance slash authoritarian state, which is problem two. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, from my standpoint, it's just Bitcoin is going to continue to do what Bitcoin does and will continue to gain global adoption because it's the classic prisoner's dilemma. There's no superpower in the world who can attack it or ban it or anything because their adversaries will then adopt it.
Got it. Yeah, I want to unpack this because there's about four or five things that I have some more doubts or objections to. So first off,
okay,
with Bitcoin, it's fully transparent in the sense of course, all the transactions are on the blockchain, but the identity of wallet holders is not fully transparent. And that's, to me, one of the core kind of thesis points of Bitcoin, you know, that you don't have to reveal your identity as a Bitcoin wallet holder. And I guess one question is, if governments, or let's say hypothetically, if the full identity of a person had to be required, a law that you had to, every Bitcoin holder, let's say all of the major governments in the world came together and said every Bitcoin holder has to reveal their identity, every Bitcoin wallet holder. And let's say Bitcoin, everyone agreed to that. Would that be the end of Bitcoin in its concept? You know, because that seems so far off from what Bitcoin and the ethos and the whole, kind of central core of what Bitcoin really stands for.
They couldn't do it. The whole thing is it's a great idea, and I'm sure governments are thinking about it. They can't enforce it.
Okay, so I want to go into that. So I've heard this argument many, many times that, governments can't enforce a ban of Bitcoin, right? And I completely disagree with this because, the precedent isn't so much that, the governments can say, hey, you can't hold Bitcoin, because then people say, oh, people will just, not show it or something, right? And just hide it or goes underground. Rather, the whole premise is the government, and this is not, again, in the next 5 or 10 years. I think this is more in the 10 to 20 year period, where Bitcoin becomes an existential threat to governments and their ability to accrue revenue. But in that case, it's like governments can simply say, hey, every transaction, right? You can't buy anything with Bitcoin and you can't pull anything with Bitcoin. And it doesn't have to be like, for example, as you're talking about type of, you know, a game theory thing where one person moves first. I think it's a much more gradual thing that happens over many years where the whole attitude toward Bitcoin starts to shift, where right now governments are like, what is this thing? You know, like, you know, tell me, what is crypto? You know, for the next 5 or 10 years, that might be the case. For maybe around year 10, they're like, oh, this is kind of taking a lot of, you know, space in the financial industry, and they're getting more concerned. But by year 10 or 15, governments could be very, very skeptical, very, very critical, very threatened by it. And so it's not so much one government chooses. It could be a very gradual thing where all of the major governments start to gradually take on more and more restrictions toward Bitcoin and other currencies. So over a period, let's say 5 years, you start to see a gradual banning. So therefore, you don't have as much of that game theory thing, I think. And then the other thing is, if the major kind of blocks of countries, so you have the US, you have Europe, you have China, India, et cetera, these major blocks, and a lot of these countries already are kind of very skeptical, critical of Bitcoin. But if these major blocks start to ban it, and you just ban the transactions, meaning you can't buy or sell and you can't pull money out of Bitcoin at all. And you have to report. That's the other thing. In 10 or 15 years, the way that this whole financial system is going, in my opinion, is people are going to have to start reporting their assets to the government. That's my kind of take, because like as the government gets more threatened, they need to raise more taxes. You know, they're going to probably require more reporting of assets. Just like, for example, with the US and FATCA, like every bank account outside of the US that suppose you have $10,000 or more, you have to report it. But then the US has all of these like tentacles all around the world with all these financial institutions, where any financial institution that doesn't agree to that is basically out of the whole financial system, right? The global financial system. So already the US has tentacles around the world creating this global net of restrictions. So it seems like, you know, to so-called do a ban of crypto, it's not this like, you know, like banning gold or alcohol back in the day. To me, it's digital. It's like you can actually, you know, find the transactions. You could force people to report their assets. And if they don't report, there can be, you know, lots of repercussions to that. And it can be gradual over 5 or 10 years, right? And so, I mean, to me, it's like banning crypto or banning Bitcoin, if it poses an existential threat, it's not going to happen until that point. Like up until the point, there's no motivation to do that. But if governments are in dire need, Bitcoin, let's say, has like $10 trillion market cap or even more, and tons of people are storing all this stuff as a safe hiding place, and they're not reporting it, the government, you know, and then all these, let's say other cryptos are pegged to Bitcoin too. And I don't know, let's say we do have kind of a Bitcoin bull world. It just seems to me the more success Bitcoin has, the more of a threat it becomes to fiat or to governments. And that gives more motivation to ban. And that's the other thing. With governments, there isn't necessarily a higher authority on earth for than governments in our kind of human structure, meaning like governments can take, you know, 90% of Google's profits if they want. Governments can seize like property, any properties they want. Like we've seen this throughout history, throughout civilizations, like, you know, governments basically have exercise ultimate authority in many ways. And so for people to say, oh, they can't ban Bitcoin, I think that's ignoring the historical precedent of what humans have empowered governments to do, which is to give authority to, you know, basically, you know, they can own anything and ban anything, essentially. Sure, there's underground stuff, but that's the thing. You have to have the ability to go underground in order to survive. But Bitcoin as a digital asset, I mean, yeah, to go underground, it's like, when the government requires every Bitcoin holder, crypto holder to report all their assets and tax all their assets. It's like, I mean, sure, you could still go like against the law and, you know, risk jail time, but how many people are really going to do that? I think to me, like that scenario just really dampens this kind of more long-term 10 to 20 year view of Bitcoin. What do you think?
They already do all that, right? You have to report now. If you experience a taxable event, you're supposed to report it to the government. Now, are people not doing it? Sure, but those are probably smaller numbers and things like that.
Actually,
right?
there's no like reporting for your net assets.
No, not for your net assets, yeah. But if you sell Bitcoin, if you spend Bitcoin, you've got to report that stuff, right? Because it's all taxable events. That's what I'm saying. Like, it's actually, they have better insight into when you're selling or buying things with Bitcoin than they do with dollars, right? If you go and you buy something at the store, you don't have to report that, right? If you walk in with $500 and you buy something at the store in cash, you don't have to report that to the government. But if I walk in and I spend $500 worth of Bitcoin, I have to report it to the government. There's already more aggressive than it is in kind of the traditional world, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that where things are headed, let's say reporting assets, like the thing with transactions is like the government doesn't really know what percent of crypto people are actually reporting, you know, their crypto transactions even, because like, how can they really identify everyone? Sure, they can identify the people with Coinbase and, you know, public accounts and stuff, but that's just part of the Bitcoin ecosystem. And right now it's fine. The governments are like, hey, you know, it's not a big deal. It's still, again, it's not even $1 trillion. Like, it won't even make a dent in taxes, right? I'm just saying, like, 10 to 20 years, if Bitcoin really does, it's, let's say, 100x, and, you know, crypto does a crazy move to mass adoption, like this, I don't see anything more threatening to the government than a financial system and monetary policy that they can't control, you know? I mean, I don't see how they're not going to ban it. I mean, that's my take.
The thing that I think everyone forgets in this whole game theory is there's going to be a Bitcoiner who's the president. There's going to be a Bitcoiner who eventually runs the Federal Reserve, right? There's going to be a Bitcoiner who is the Speaker of the House. Like, we already see there was a woman who was just elected to the Senate. She's now the first senator. She went into it saying, very pro-Bitcoin, I hold Bitcoin, I believe in Bitcoin, and she was just elected to the Senate in Wyoming. There's people in the in Congress who have to report, do they hold this stuff or do they not, right? And you're starting to see it. There's a gentleman, Congressman Davidson from Ohio, who openly tweets about and talks about, hey, this is this great technology, we need to embrace this, all this kind of stuff. And so if we kind of like did a freeze frame on the, you know, unfortunately 60 plus year olds who are running a lot of the government organizations, and fast forward 5 or 10 years, I completely agree, right? We've seen a congressman in California, for example, call for the banning of Bitcoin and you know, all this kind of really, really extreme type reactions. But what I think people forget is that the government's going to change as well, right? And what you're going to start to see is, like, you know, if you talked a lot about taxes, why does the government take taxes if they just can edit their bank account? You now have an entire generation of people who are literally growing up asking that question, right? And I used to think of, you know, that was kind of a taboo subject, right? Like, oh, people kind of know it, but like no one would ever say it out loud. But then if you go on Twitter and you like literally search for people saying it, I'm talking about venture capitalists, I'm talking about hedge fund managers, I'm talking about, you know, people in state and local governments. Like, this is becoming much more of a narrative. Now, do I think that the government will stop collecting taxes? Absolutely not, right? I'm with you that if anything, they're going to try to continue to raise taxes and things like that. But what I do think is going to happen is they're just going to get more aggressive with the fiat system that they have. And I actually don't think there's a world where, in order for Bitcoin to succeed, the dollar has to fail. Right, today we've got about 100 million Bitcoin holders, right? That would, if it was a stock, would make it the most popular stock on any stock market in the world, right? In terms of how many people hold it. So like, this thing is already held by lots and lots of people around the world in terms of a financial asset. Now compare that to dollars, it's not even close, right? There's literally 330 million Americans who all interact with the dollar, let alone everyone else internationally. And so I think that you start thinking through, like, it's probably not as black and white as just like ban, not ban, right? Does it all happen in one moment or not? So I do think that you're correct in kind of that thought process. The thing that I keep going back to though is they're gonna have no choice. Like, the US dollar is going to fail, right? And I don't know when that happens. And, you know, I always tell people, like, I hope it doesn't happen in my lifetime. Like, that's a really, really scary situation where the US dollar literally through monetary policy is just devalued away enough until it literally fails. Well, that sounds absolutely crazy, especially 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. Now you start to look and say, wait a second, we're doing the same thing that Venezuela did, that Zimbabwe did, that these other countries have done. And yes, are we quote unquote smarter? Are we more disciplined? Do we have more checks and balances? Like, of course, right? That's what makes America, America. But there has never been a currency that has been devalued over a long period of time that ends up remaining the global reserve currency. And so I think what you start to realize is, like, what is going to be the next one? right? And is it just going to be another nation state currency? Or if you actually think about every single economy has a currency, right? So the United States economy has the US dollar. The Chinese economy has a currency. The Russian economy has a currency, right? And they've kind of been these micro economies when you compare it to the global financial system. Some are bigger than others, right? Well, the internet economy, the digital economy, does not have a native currency. Bitcoin now is stepping in and serving as that native currency. Now, will it continue? I think yes. Plenty of people think no. But if that occurs, what you start to realize is the biggest thing that ends up happening is, regardless of what the United States thinks, they can't do anything about it, right? And when I say they can't do anything about it, sure, can they affect the 330 million people in the United States? Absolutely. Right? Can they say to other banks internationally, hey, you've got to do what we say, or we're going to kick you out of the, you know, US-led global financial system? Sure. But what we're already seeing is it's not Bitcoin is being built to then get bolted onto the existing system. There's a whole second global financial system that's being built, right? There's literally right now, as we talk, there are people trading US-based stocks, but they're doing it on a digital decentralized exchange that isn't controlled by the United States.
Sure.
And there's nothing that the CEO can do, that the owners of the exchange can do, that anyone in the government can do. Now, there's a lot of people who get excited about that, and they're super, you know, they're like, oh my God, this is amazing. Let's go like decentralize the world. I always remind people, like, that is a very, very big divergence from the way of life that we have today. And with that comes a ton of risk and actually probably problems as well, right? It's not just, hey, the grass is greener, like let's go decentralize everything. And so there's got to kind of be this balance between how do you have coexistence between the existing system and this new system. Where I actually think that you're going to get kind of the divergence is the analog world, right? Which is really the dollar-based system, gold, all that kind of stuff. And then this digital world. And in the digital world, what you're seeing already is like Bitcoin, in terms of on-chain transaction volume, it was transacted more on-chain. So not traded on exchanges, not kind of all of the wash trading and all that kind of crazy stuff. Just like actual use for commerce on-chain. It was more popular last year than Apple Pay, Venmo, or PayPal. And we started to think about that. You say, wait a second. You're telling me that people use, from a transaction volume standpoint, Bitcoin more than they used PayPal last year. Of course, because it's just globally available, right? How many countries in the world don't support PayPal, or PayPal doesn't support that country? A lot, right? I don't know what the number is, but it's a lot. And that's just because they are tied to the global financial system. There's geographic rollouts, you know, kind of regulatory things, etc. And so I think that what people underestimate is this idea of what the internet did to business, right? The internet basically said, I'm going to take Dave's business, I'm going to digitize it, and I'm now going to open it up. And regardless of where you are geographically, you can now interact with, buy goods or services from Dave. There's not very many businesses that went from an analog to a digital version where the digital version is not bigger than the analog version, right? What I think is happening with Bitcoin is basically the same thing. We're taking analog currencies. Yes, now are they electronic in that I can go to the bank and you know, there's numbers in a centralized database, all that, of course. But this idea of taking the same thing that the internet did around democratization and decentralization and things like that, bringing it to a currency, and what you're going to see is that it's so powerful, the governments are going to have no choice, right? Because ultimately what ends up happening is if they do try to ban it, again, the countries that do that are the ones that are going to suffer, right?
Yeah, like, I mean, I would disagree because, like, for example, over a period, let's say 2030 to 2035, let's say, you know, all the major country blocks, you know, ban, let's say, Bitcoin, crypto, outside of their own cryptocurrencies, like, I don't think that they'll suffer that much because, let's say, you have the whole first world banning it. You might have, like, you know, fringe underdeveloped countries.
But they'll never cooperate with each other. Why would China, Russia, and India agree to do that with the United States?
No, they don't even have to agree. For example, if, let's say, China, Europe, you know, US and other countries, let's say, hey, you can't hold Bitcoin and you can't transact in Bitcoin, and they require reporting of assets and stuff. It's like you're going to be going against the law to hold Bitcoin in that scenario. You're going to see a massive flow out of Bitcoin. I mean, most people do not want to go to jail, you know? And because of that, you're going to see a massive flow. And then you're going to see maybe like you can have a underdeveloped, you know, third world, you know, infrastructure. Maybe Bitcoin runs that as a financial system.
But how many people outside the United States hold Bitcoin today? I don't know the exact number, but my guess is more than 50% of those 100 million people, right, or somewhere around 50%, are not in the United States.
Yeah, but
they're not affected by the United States banning it.
No, but that's what I'm saying. If the U.S., Europe, China, let's say India, et cetera, and major blocks, let's say, ban it, you'll have like, you know, that's probably like, what, 80, 90% of the global economy right there, you know, if you take the major industrialized, you know, blocks. And you have, sure, Bitcoin can become like a fringe, you know, kind of money system for the fringe economy. I don't see how the developed countries will suffer for banning Bitcoin. I think they just have more to gain in the sense that it strengthens their own cryptocurrency, they want a monopoly on monetary policy. They want a monopoly to create money and to hold that value.
They have one.
Exactly. They're going to keep that monopoly because it's existential. Without it, literally governments can fall without the ability to print money, you know? And who wants to give that away?
I think you just identified, again, this scares the shit out of me. But I think that is what is going to happen. Because again, they can want to ban it all they want. They can want to do all these different things. At the end of the day, you can't print money forever, right? And again, this stuff may literally happen. Somebody may be watching this video 500 years from now and be like, wow, that Dave guy and Pomp, they really nailed this. And we're long gone, right? I don't know how long it takes. But I just think that we're getting to a point where we don't have sound money. And because we don't have sound money, we've had all kinds of issues and we've become addicted to the stimulus, right? All the things you're saying, completely agree as to like that's what happens right now. What I'm saying is that there's basically a faction of people around the world who have said, I don't want to play this game anymore. And they're now going over into this new system, right? That's built around a new global reserve currency. Does it survive? That's the big question, right? That's kind of what we're talking about here.
Exactly.
If it does, of course the old system falls, right? And again, that scares the hell out of everyone, right? Including myself.
Yeah.
It's just like, that's the framework, I think.
Yeah. I think most people, they don't understand the implications of Bitcoin and crypto, like 10 to 20 years out. Like this is a massive epic battle, you know, this is literally the survival of governments at stake. And I mean, that's just so intriguing.
Unless the governments embrace Bitcoin. Well, yeah,
true. But then if they embrace Bitcoin, the government power and status just radically decreases too. Yeah.
Now you know why every libertarian in the world loves Bitcoin.
No, yeah. It's pretty, yeah. It's the dream, you know? Okay. I'm going to throw another kind of take care. Here's the reason why I think Bitcoin will never be the global reserve currency. And it goes down to the essence of currency and what makes currency valuable. Personally, I don't think it's like, you know, per se, let's say being pegged to gold or another asset per se. I think the reason why we see kind of all currencies in history be deflationary, right, and no global currency stick around is because the income earning power of countries are always going up and down, right? That's the story of history. And so no civilization is able to continually increase their income producing ability. And so it's just like stocks, for example. As long as the stock is going up, you know, then it's like, great, the stock price is great. But once you have a company whose earnings are going down, the market just punishes that company, you know, and they're moving out of all their assets to another, let's say, stock who's going up. And so in the same way, the global currency is basically the country that has the strongest and the brightest and the most kind of, the strongest income earning potential now and also kind of in the foreseeable future. And when you're buying into that currency and when you're buying into, let's say, treasury-backed notes and all that stuff, you're buying into not just that whatever piece of money, of course, you're buying into a part of a contract where you're buying a certain percent of that country's future earning power. So regardless of, you know, let's say there's inflation or let's say, you know, in the US, hypothetically, let's say in the next 20 years, you have massive inflation. But let's say hypothetically, there's also massive productivity gains and there's massive amounts of, let's say, income and GDP increases too. The dollar still can be very strong in the sense that you're, as a holder of a dollar, you're banking on the power of that U.S. government to back that currency. And as long as the U.S. government is the government of a strong economy, of a growing, basically income-producing population, basically they own the right to pull that income a certain percent or even as much as they want, you know? And that's why, in a sense, we have, I think, the global currencies. And if the U.S. starts to go down in its income-producing revenue potential, of course, we'll see a shifting maybe toward another country or block of countries for a global reserve currency. But in that sense, these global reserve currencies have some intrinsic value, meaning kind of dividend value, like when you look at a stock, where you can, they're based upon the earning potential of this country forever, like going out in the future. That's actually quite appealing in a sense. And that's what, in a sense, makes me like understand, it's obvious why we have the currencies we do. With Bitcoin, on the other hand, you don't have that type of contract on these future earnings on 500 million people or a billion people or whatever. Like, that to me is really bullish. If I can say, hey, I have a contract on, you know, 300 million people in this country, all of their earnings and all of the future revenue for forever, that's actually as an investor, that's like, hey, you know, that's impressive. For Bitcoin, you don't really have that intrinsic kind of dividend producing value where you're saying Bitcoin, hey, this is producing income, right? For the next 1,000 years. Like, where is that income? Where is that revenue, so, right?
So one of the things that I would say is the example you gave is theoretically correct, but in practice is where it breaks down. And so what I mean by that is, let's say that you you decided, okay, I want to own 1% of that future production, right? So I'm going to take basically 1% of all dollars and I want to own that. What we've seen is that you're relying on the fact that the government doesn't just go and increase the Federal Reserve balance sheet by 75%. Right. And then all of a sudden your 1% is no longer 1%. Right. And you kind of continue to basically against your will and with no say vote, you know, or any sort of exercise of kind of that vote, you basically just get devalued down. And that's basically what happens. Right. So I agree kind of from a framework standpoint, that's how it's supposed to work. The problem is that we continue to see just the lack of discipline. Right. And ultimately what it comes down to is like, we don't want to see people suffer, right? Like we're a country that is empathetic, actually. You saw it earlier this year in March, for example, right? Like we went and we said, okay, we got to shut down our country. There was a ton of economic kind of repercussions for that. Some of that was, you know, easily identified as like short-term things. Hey, if you shut your business down, okay, there's no revenue. You can't pay your employees. But when we turn it back on, like we're ready to go. But in kind of the empathetic nature of our country and many other countries around the world, we say, look, we can't let people suffer for 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, whatever it is. So the Federal Reserve and elected officials step in with these stimulus packages and kind of do all this stuff. Well, ultimately what ends up happening is the reason why they have to do that is because they have financially engineered a system that rewards people for spending their money. Right? The whole idea of an inflationary currency is like, we're going to continue to devalue this. So you're financially incentivized to either invest it or to spend it, but not to hold it. Right? And so like, that sounds great when everything's going well. But when you get into the bad times, immediately everyone goes, oh shoot, I should have saved all my money. Right? And like held all my cash. I can't do that. So what do? They basically said, okay, well, the things I spent money on, I can't get that money back. Instead, what they say is I'm going to sell all my assets I can and raise capital that way. Right? And that's where you get these liquidity crisis, asset prices go down, all that kind of stuff. But what I think ultimately we're starting to see is like those inflationary currencies are inferior to a deflationary system like we see with Bitcoin, right? The thing is that we just have encouraged the consumption mindset of we have to devalue the currency in order to get wage growth, production growth, you know, economic output, velocity of money, like all this stuff. Well, yes, if you're over-engineering an economy, of course that's what you have to do, right? But if you instead say, no, actually by having sound money in which kind of the value does not get manipulated through intervention, you don't need any of that stuff, right? And so what I think you're starting to see is, again, the price volatility of Bitcoin is like one of the most fascinating things to me, because when the price goes up a lot, like it has over the last couple of weeks, everyone, their mom, their barber, their taxi driver, their neighbor, you know, whoever, they're all like, oh my God, did you see Bitcoin? I need to go buy Bitcoin. Like I'm gonna get rich, right? And like everyone rushes in. But what happens is some of those people will get flushed out, you know, when the price crashes over time, whatever, and be kind of before the next bull market. But some portion of people stay, Right. I kind of think of it like if you're growing a mobile app, you kind of bring in a bunch of new users, you have a, you know, a bunch churn out, and then you kind of retain some set of those users. Well, those people who came for the money, right, who came to get rich quickly, they begin on this exploration of like learning, like, what is Bitcoin? What is money? How does monetary policy work? And they kind of go down the rabbit hole, and then they stay for the money, but not for getting rich, but for the sound money, right? And so what I think we're starting to see is this like really weird world of the inflationary currencies are proving around the world to not work for a very large portion of the demographic, right? Like in the United States, the widening wealth inequality gap is attributable to one thing and one thing alone. It's inflation. Right. We literally have 45% of Americans don't own a stock. 50% can't come up with more than $400 to live paycheck to paycheck. If we did not have inflation, or we had 100% of our citizen base in inflation adjusted wage contracts, you would drastically reduce that wealth inequality gap. Right. And so what you start to see is something like Bitcoin that comes around and says, well, we don't have inflation. Actually, your savings is going to get more valuable over time because the inflation rate goes down over time. Right? You actually accrue more value as more and more people adopt this thing. And so what you start to get to is like Bitcoin is likely to usher in a much more equitable world, right? In terms of kind of everyone having the ability to rise faster in an economy based on their production value versus in this kind of inflationary system, right? You know, 50 plus percent of Americans literally getting poorer and poorer over time, even though to no fault of their own, they're doing what we've told them to do, right? They go to work, they basically save their money, like they do all these things. It's just they can't get ahead. And so I think that's kind of the reckoning that is coming is, you know, the stock market. Last thing I'll leave you with. The stock market, if you denominate it in dollars, it's a perfect 45 degree angle up and to the right. If you denominate that same stock market since 1971 in gold, the stock market's down. Why is that, right? Is the stock market actually always going up, you know, 7-8% because the value of the companies in the stock market are going up? Or is it because there's the devaluation of the dollar, right? Housing. I mean, you just go through all of these things, right? And it's like, wait a minute, are we literally just manipulating an economy by devaluing the currency that it is measured in, and therefore it's quote unquote getting more expensive, right? And so therefore an investor gets richer, or is there actual true value accrual? And I think that's part of the conversation people now are waking up to and say, wait a second, this sounds like, you know, this game doesn't play forever, yeah. Right?
Yeah, I disagree on some, actually quite a few things there.
I like talking to you because when you disagree, I learn. Go ahead.
Yeah, because you know, inflation is part of the story, obviously, right? But there's also a whole global type of innovation slash we're going through massive industrial revolutions right now, right? With the computer, with the internet, now with AI, that's causing those who are aligned with those industries to profit immensely, including people with capital, et cetera. And so I think the wealth gap is complicated. I think there are different reasons. But back to your point about, Here's where I want to address is this whole thing of Bitcoin is still not pegged to something that I'm excited about. Meaning, for example, the U.S. government, I'm not going to, for example, hold, let's say, 1% of the dollars out there for 20 years. I mean, I'll be crazy to do that. But let's say I own 1% of all the dollars, not just cash out there, but let's say on the Fed balance sheet, et cetera. And let's say in 20 years, I own 1%. Of the same thing, right? Like that's not a terrible thing in my opinion because I'm owning 1% of all of the future revenue or percent of people's revenue in that entire country for the foreseeable future, right? For as long as, you know, I live or whoever holds my assets lives. And so that type of being pegged to actual people's income and working, these are 300 million people who are working hard, you know, that's what the U.S. is pegging their currency and the strength of the currency on. For Bitcoin, the thing that they're pegging their currency on, in my opinion, is they're pegging the currency on adoption, on basically on people believing in the currency and putting in their wealth in that currency. And I call it, in a sense, it's popular. There's demand for that currency. That's what gives Bitcoin its value. There isn't necessarily 100 million people's revenue pegged to that. Like Bitcoin doesn't own the revenue of 100 million people.
There's something more valuable. This is like I'm going to pull you down the rabbit hole, because this is exactly like every single person kind of falls a little bit, does a little research, right? And like lands right where you are. And like, what the hell is this thing pegged to? Bitcoin is pegged to the most valuable commodity in the world today, but it is also the most misunderstood commodity, which is computing power. So when people think of commodities, they think of oil, gold, kind of all the traditional commodities, right? Computing power is the most important commodity by far into the future world, right? And so you hear things like data is the new oil and kind of all this stuff. The Bitcoin network is the strongest computing network in the world. If you took the four largest supercomputers in the world, the most powerful supercomputers, times 300, I believe, is the Bitcoin network, right? So you took the four greatest supercomputers, put them together, multiplied it by 300, you get the Bitcoin computing network. So the strongest computing network in the world today is valued at $275 billion. The misunderstanding of that is incredible. Now, why is that important, right? When I say that it is pegged to, like, what's the intrinsic value? It's a misunderstood commodity, because it's ultimately, Bitcoin is only valuable if that Bitcoin network remains decentralized and unhacked, right? It has to remain secure, has to remain decentralized. If either one of those two things goes away, Bitcoin will become less valuable, if not, you know, completely non-valuable at all. And so because it is tied to that, it is the first time where people don't buy into the cash flow around computing power. So like Amazon would be, you know, AWS would be a great example of that. Instead, now you can just buy into the actual computing power itself, right? And the number of computers, the reason why they are all pointed at that Bitcoin network and running that network is because there's a financial incentive, which is the Bitcoin mining. And we don't have to get into kind of all the technicalities, but there's a reason why they're doing it. And so what I always tell people is, if you think of one, the Bitcoin network today, which is the strongest computing network in the world, is valued at $275 billion, and you think that that's overvalued, you and I are probably going to disagree, right? So like I always kind of start there. Then I say, if you believe that a currency, let's say that the one that you described, is more valuable being tied to the economic output of an aging population like the United States of 300 million people versus the strongest computing network in the world, right? I would rather the strongest computing network in the world rather than the aging 300 million population of the United States. Now, the United States population and some of the demographics and stuff is actually better than other countries, right? So if you look at Japan, you know, you kind of go around the world and compare demographics. So it's not like the US is the worst, right? But they're not the best either, right? If you look maybe somewhere like Nigeria, for example, the younger demographics and things like that. So I always look at it as like, yes, in the kind of legacy system, what you're describing is the exact way to think about it. The difference, though, is we don't live in that world anymore. We're now living in this digital world. And in the digital world, the most important commodity, actually, like oil went negative this year, right? I always laugh, like everyone's yelling Bitcoin's going to zero and then oil went zero, right? And
so, kind like, of, not it's just the contracts for the near term month, yeah.
But I think it was, you know, a single digit dollars, right, for Bitcoin for oil at one point earlier this year, like $10, whatever it ended up actually the barrels themselves going to. And so when you kind of look at that, what you start to understand is the computing power as a commodity is so underpriced and misunderstood that the people who begin to look at, there's only 21 million Bitcoin. So whereas you are buying into the future production of 300 million people, you actually this year own much less of that production than you thought you were going to at the beginning of the year. So in just, you know, 10 months, 11 months, already they've diluted your ownership of that future production, right? And they can continue to do it. They're going to print another $2 trillion, right? Another $2 trillion stimulus package, give or take. And so when that happens, again, they dilute your ownership. Mm. With Bitcoin, what ends up happening is if you own one Bitcoin, you own one 21 millionth of that network. And over time, it is likely that some of those are going to get lost. They're going to get, you know, destroyed, whatever happens. And so it's going to increase your ownership rather than decrease your ownership, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've got...
What do you agree and disagree?
I've got so many things on this. this is great. So computing power. Okay. Computing power, in my opinion, as a commodity, is only has value in its application of its computing power, meaning it's the computing power itself, like it needs to somehow generate revenue in some type of application, some type of form, right? And therefore, that's why, you know, it's you have these companies who are creating the form or the value, the products or the services that create value to use the computing power for, right? So in that sense, there's a, it's not so much computing power has this crazy value. It's that is there, but it's a commodity. It means it's commoditized in some ways. It's the value of the companies that build products and services on top of that, that produce the revenues, right, off of that.
That's what Bitcoin is.
Exactly.
Right? Because it's decentralized and the miners get about $13.5 million a day right now in revenue for processing transactions, running the network, et cetera.
Sure. So what Bitcoin is doing is it's an application, right? Basically using computing power, right, to provide value to a certain group of people, right?
Agreed.
And with that, it's like, there's a few things with that. It's like that computing power, there's a few things. Like, first off, a lot of that computing power is required because of its decentralized nature, meaning like the whole, you know, essence of Bitcoin, in my opinion, is how to make decentralized money work, you know? Mm-hmm. And in order to make that work and to solve the Byzantine generalist problem, all this other stuff, you have to use massive amounts of computing power and only increase that computing power over time to keep it secure. Now, with that, it's like you're betting on the decentralized nature. If you pull out the decentralized nature of what Bitcoin offers, and then the whole kind of, in my opinion, the value of Bitcoin, the whole computing network, it doesn't mean much anymore. And that's where I compare it with, like, you can't look at Bitcoin as just this isolated vacuum, you know, kind of coin here. I think you need to compare it with a centralized cryptocurrency. And when you look at a centralized ledger is like a million times or billion times, it's just infinitively more efficient than a decentralized ledger, because most of 99.99% of the computing power of Bitcoin is used for to keep the decentralized nature of Bitcoin. So, for example, if a government crypto, you know, if a government and government blocks establish their own cryptos, they don't need the decentralized nature. So they can establish actually a high level of security, equal or even surpassing Bitcoin itself in a lot of ways through crypto, because it's a centralized ledger system. They can establish basically comparable security with far less resources and computing power. So Bitcoin, in a sense, it's giving a product or service of a decentralized, you know, money system. Mm-hmm. And it's using an immense amount of computing power. But in that way, it's not really, in my opinion, an asset per se. It's an expense. The computing power Bitcoin uses, in a way, is an expense to keep the decentralized money system going that it has. Right.
Well, it all comes back to how important is the decentralization.
Exactly.
And the decentralization in the eyes of Bitcoiners is the most important.
Exactly. And that's what I'm saying. Right. The value of Bitcoin lies in its demand, in the perceived value from people that this is super important. It's going to grow in the future. It's solving a pain point, a problem, et cetera. And that's where I have one of my biggest qualms with Bitcoin 10 to 20 years down in the future, where it's not pegged to as strong of intrinsic value as a company's, let's say, 300 million people, or let's say a company's future cash flows over time.
So, right? Yeah. So one of the things that's happening right now is, I personally believe, every stock, bond, currency, and commodity is going to get traded on Bitcoin as well. So this is an important thing. Bitcoin, as we know, the most technical, brightest minds are usually not the best marketers, right? And that's a compliment, because frankly, they're too smart to be marketers. Sure. But whoever named Bitcoin the network with a capital B, and then Bitcoin the asset, a lowercase b, right? So you can hold Bitcoin in your digital wallet, and then when you want to send it, you send it on the Bitcoin network, right? Those are two different things. They have the same name, and you basically delineate them between a capital letter and a lowercase letter. Bitcoin the network, people now are starting to say, wait a second, why don't I actually tokenize or digitize that stock, for example, on the Bitcoin network, and then I can transact it. So ultimately, what I think you're getting at, and just kind of more expanding on it, it's not just a decentralized currency. It really ultimately would be like a decentralized financial system, right? So it's every stock, bond, currency, commodity being decentralized. If that's important, then yes, this will become super valuable. if that ends up not being important, right, there's much more efficient ways to just do digitized, right, that are not decentralized, kind of a centralized version. And frankly, look, I mean, the New York Stock Exchange, if you were to look at their computing power compared to Bitcoin, the New York Stock Exchange looks like peanuts, right? And and it's because it's a centralized system that basically doesn't need anywhere near the computing power that Bitcoin does. But it's also because what they gain in efficiency, they give up in that decentralization, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that, I mean, that's the whole thing. I mean, it's the whole, like, the need for decentralization, right? I mean, I would disagree that stocks and bonds would be traded on, say, a Bitcoin type of system because of the massive amounts of computing power and costs associated that would be required to make that move to decentralization would completely outweigh any benefits. Because right now, I don't think there's a ton of people. I mean, there's maybe some, but the vast majority of people aren't complaining that, you know, that their stocks are in a centralized system. You know, it's like they're fine with just holding, you know, the stocks as is. I mean, that's the thing with Bitcoin. One of the concerns is, you know, I've heard a ton of arguments from people saying, hey, it's the first of its kind. It's got the market share. It's got the security, right? You've got this humongous, you know, computing network keeping it secure. Any new crypto would have to withstand all the hacks, you know, of the established system, and therefore it'd be hard to get up and running. So you've got like, you've got this, I understand, like, you know, the argument of how strong Bitcoin is, and those arguments, I find validity for the next 5 or 10 years, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think demand is an interesting, or just even network effects, right? Of having mm-hmm. kind of a network. I understand all that stuff. The thing is, what I'm most concerned about Bitcoin is more 10 to 20 years down the road is a lot of times those type of demand arguments and network effects arguments and first, you know, to market, you know, establishing all this stuff, it can evolve to different types of technologies, et cetera. All of that stuff sounds, it's a decent argument for the near term, for the next, you know, 5 years. But for the next 10 to 20 years, it's like, I think it still doesn't solve the essential problem of Bitcoin as, for example, the store of value that people are attributing it to, where if half the people or more decide to, let's say in 10 or 15 years, and let's say it coincides with a massive government crackdown, let's say across the world, all the major governments, let's say 75%, 85%, you know, they exit Bitcoin, but they can't even go back in because of concerns of going to jail, et cetera. You have a massive drop in the demand of Bitcoin and its usefulness. It goes to more of the fringe, the third world, underdeveloped world. Like that stuff is a possible scenario. Now, we're going to probably disagree on the percent of possibility, mm-hmm. right? You might have a certain percent, I might have a certain percent. But because of its lack of, like, for example, I'm studying like SpaceX and Starlink. When I look out for the numbers on Starlink satellite system, like I can't stop but to see a possible $1 trillion valuation in the year 2030 because of its cash flows and income. It's just like, it's pretty clear to me. But when I look at Bitcoin, it's like, I don't see that type of like intrinsic value. Like, it's hard to model it, you know, and project it because a lot of it is based on demand. And if, let's say you're right, and Bitcoin is the ultimate system, right? It just, you know, succeeds in every way. Then yeah, that adoption itself will justify its price, you know, whatever it may be. But there's many scenarios and different scenarios. I think some, you know, people or Bitcoin bulls might not give a lot of credence to, but are realistic possibilities where Bitcoin doesn't turn out to be the ultimate, you know, monetary financial system. And in that case, the whole demand, you know, network effects, all these arguments that have been built up over the years by Bitcoin bulls don't really, you know, hold its weight. I mean, what's your take?
So is there a world where Bitcoin does not become the global reserve currency? Of course, right? Like the probability of Bitcoin becoming the global reserve currency when it was launched in 2009, if you said 1%, you were like the bull of bulls, right? Like that would have been nuts. Now, like, I don't know, maybe single digit percentages, right? Like whatever it's done has definitely de-risked itself in terms of that trajectory. Is there a world where people still demand it and it's not the global reserve currency? I think yes. And mainly I just look at gold, right? Like it could serve as a store of value and not a medium of exchange. Now, that's very uninteresting to a lot of kind of Bitcoiners, and they want to be able to spend it and kind of do all the things that a currency does on a global reserve basis. But just the idea of, hey, I can save in this thing and it protects me from inflation, I think there will always be a market for that, right? And if you kind of think of sound money today, the analog application of that has been gold, and gold has it's definitely wavered in terms of popularity. Like 2010 and 11, it was super popular. Kind of, you know, interest went away. Obviously, Fed steps in this year, becomes popular again, it hits another all-time high. I think that that's what you're going to see here, right? Is like if it doesn't become a global reserve currency, people will just use it as like digital gold. Now, I think that it has the opportunity to become that global reserve currency, but I don't think it's kind of as binary as global reserve currency or zero. I think of it more as like almost like these arcs or trajectories, right? And so like, you know, you want the biggest arc possible because that means you can go the farthest, right? And if you don't get that one, then you want the next biggest one, and then the next biggest one. And then eventually like you could end up like, oh, it just is what it is today. It's a $275 billion asset, and you know, 100 million people hold it in the world, and it's got whatever narrative it has, and those people will literally die holding Bitcoin, and you know, that's it. I don't think that's likely, but like that could be kind of an outcome. So I kind of look at it more so as like Bitcoiners will always shoot for that highest trajectory. And then based on this level of success, it may not reach that. It could reach something else. It's just, you know, I've probably got an outsized amount of confidence compared to most in terms of that highest trajectory.
Sure. Okay. I want to actually dive into this concept of store value and compare Bitcoin with real estate. And so like I hear a lot of Bitcoiners compare Bitcoin with gold, right? Saying Bitcoin is the digital gold, et cetera, one of a kind, can't be reproduced, et cetera. And when I hear that argument, I kind of go like, I scratch my head and I'm like, you know, gold is not really, in my opinion, like the main store of value in the world. Like to me, gold is like, man, we're talking about, this is like even before the gold standard. I mean, in my opinion, real estate is probably one of the biggest areas of store of value, right? Mm-hmm.
Art, real estate, there's a bunch of them. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, I would say like real estate is probably, you know, 10,000 times more than art, if not more, you know?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I think the art market's like less than $2 trillion, sure. And real estate's, you know, 20 or whatever it is.
Actually, I would.
Or I guess 200, right? Maybe it's 200.
Yeah, I would say like it's even undervalued in this sense because like, It's like if you go to almost any country in the world, you know, it's like their greatest assets usually, I mean, it's either the companies or the real estate. Usually the real estate is much of a greater asset. And so what I would argue is I would say actually in the past, you know, many, many years, generation or few generations, people have shifted this concept of store value as gold is like, to me, it's archaic. You know, I don't even like understand it completely.
All right. We agree on that.
Yeah. People have already shifted their store value to real estate, stocks and bonds more as like an appreciable kind of investment, you know, tool, but real estate to hold value. And when I look at real estate, at least it's got some intrinsic value, meaning real estate, I can rent it out, you know, for a certain amount of money per month. Sure, it might not, you know, be a fantastic return in some areas, but at least, you know, whatever the residence or whatever the commercial property, whatever, you know, there is some income producing potential. And not just that, I have the rights to that property for, you know, as long as the government, you know, exists and I exist, et cetera. And I can pass on that property too. And so in a lot of ways, real estate holds one of the strongest store value arguments to me, because historically, if you look at just, you know, thousands of years, real estate is actually very appealing. It has intrinsic value, which gold doesn't have. And then the other thing is geographic trends are a lot more slower to be realized than, let's say, digital trends, right? Say, you know, everyone moving out of LA, right, to somewhere else, I'm going to be able to see that, you know, before it happens versus, you know, if Bitcoin, like, you know, all the whales bail or something, most people think that's impossible, but still it can happen faster than, you know, people. Yep. Than a geographic kind of, you know, real estate move. So when I look at that, I'm like, I can understand Bitcoin's store value case in for those people in certain countries with oppressive governments who can seize their real estate assets, and they're scared of that. And they're like, hey, I need to put right a certain percent in digital currency. And that makes complete sense, because they understand the risks of possession of their real estate, which is a risk. However, for most of the world, especially the first world, the chances of government coming down and, you know, possessing right your real estate is very, very just unlikely, especially for the foreseeable future. And so, like, when people, Bitcoiners say, you know, digital gold, store of value, I'm just like, man, gold, digital gold, that's not very appealing to me. Like, it's based on popularity. It has little intrinsic value. It's not pegged to, like, you know, a ton of income producing stuff. I would say, hey, better store value is like real estate overall. You know, you got some intrinsic value, so more historical precedent. What makes
the real estate valuable? It sounds like scarcity, right? Like, there's only so much land in a certain area or whatever. So there's some scarcity argument there. There, it sounds like the income producing component of it, and then the tangibility of it, right? The ability to hey, it's land, it's a building, it's that type of stuff. I can go live in it, right? All of that.
Well, yeah, it's got this use, like, a use case where you can actually, like, yeah, you know, live your life. It protects, it provides shelter, it provides safety, it provides, like, all sorts of stuff. Even for a business, it provides, you know, a place to work out of. Like, there's, yeah, obviously there's a lot of uses.
All right. So Bitcoin is all of those things, but in a superior fashion. It's more scarce, right? There's only 21 million, and I can prove the scarcity of it versus the real estate, right? Two is, when you look at it from an income producing standpoint, you can take your Bitcoin, just like you can rent your house to somebody. I can rent my Bitcoin to somebody and they'll pay me interest for it, right? Just like I can do that with dollars or any other asset. So I can make it income producing. And then the most important part is, when you talk about it in terms of sheltering and all that, what it ultimately is doing is it's sheltering me from tyrannical governments, authoritarianism, right? From surveillance states, like all that kind of stuff. So it is absolutely a completely different thing, right? And that we're talking about a currency versus, like, literally you can go live there. But at the same time, I actually think that there's a lot of similarities, right? One's digital, one's analog, and you got to kind of, you know, really be open-minded when you look at it that way. But I do think that there's more similarities than most people realize between a real estate investment and Bitcoin. The thing is that Bitcoin's just this new thing that people haven't thought of it in that way. Mm-hmm. Right. And so what I 100% agree with you on, and I think I'm hearing you kind of say this a couple of times now, is like, there is a possibility that what I just said about Bitcoin kind of being digital real estate in some people's eyes, there's a possibility that's true. Definitely. The probability, in your opinion, is just much lower than not. Right. So it's kind of like, yes, that is a possible version of the future. It's just, where does somebody's confidence level lie on how likely is that future? Right. And I actually think that you're probably one of my favorite people to have talked to this about, because, like, the binary world of, like, it works, it doesn't work for any asset, right? It literally, for your house, for Bitcoin, for whatever, just is not, it's not the way that the real world works, right? It's all probabilities. And so sure. I think that's the right way to kind of look through it. And just understanding, like, okay, here's the similarities and the differences between other assets. And then just, what's the probability, right? Mm-hmm. So I think you're thinking about it the right way. I probably just have much more confidence. The thing I would say to you, though, I've even surprised myself. Somebody said this to me, so it's not my idea. They said, the more time you spend learning about Bitcoin, the more confident or the higher probability you start to assign to those outcomes, right? And so if you're at, you know, 2% likely, maybe you only go to 4 or 5%. But that's, you doubled the you know, kind of confidence level you had, right? And so I think that's what becomes really interesting is, you know, just kind of spending the time to really learn about it, like you're doing right now. Mm-hmm. And eventually people just become more and more convinced, you know, to whatever degree that this is a possibility that may occur.
Yeah. Like, the way I look at it, and this is kind of a different take, but if people are going to argue, like, a store of value as one of the main arguments for Bitcoin's value, then, like, I think they need to back it up with some type of stability. Because, for example, I think store of value does go hand in hand with, this needs to be a stable asset. I think Bitcoiners have created this vast, you know, network of arguments to say, hey, this is super scarce and it creates value and whatever, all this stuff. But in my opinion, I just don't think it's as strong as more of a argument where Bitcoin is, like, it does have some store value, like, value and potential. I'm not going to disagree with that. Obviously the the probabilities of its future store value potential is I don't know. So I'm not going to say it doesn't have store value, but it seems to me, though, that most people's motivation with Bitcoin, I don't say most people, but Bitcoin as an investment, Bitcoin as a trading vehicle for the next few years, right? As demand continues to increase, because we see some visibility toward that. You know, we see different holders, different institutions, different companies get more open and interested in Bitcoin, and you start to see more anxiety with the fiat currency system. And so Bitcoin as a trade, as an investment for the next few years, next 5 years, like, hey, that's actually a pretty strong argument to me. You know, I'm like, hey, I can't argue with that. Like, you lay down the numbers, you lay down the trends, and things line up, right? I can understand that. Like, hey, Bitcoin.
Yeah, increasing demand, fixed supply, exactly. Price should go up. Yeah, I got you.
We're talking about the essence of economics, you know, essence of value. Like, I can't argue against that. Whether it happened or not, there's different probabilities, of course. But that to me is a strong argument, right? The next 5 years, like Bitcoin as an investment, seeing it appreciate. Bitcoin as a store of value as the main argument is like 95% of the reason why I'm buying Bitcoin is because of its store of value. Like that to me is a little bit of a weaker argument just because it doesn't have that stability of let's say real estate, unless you're maybe in a third world situation, but you have this just a long precedent of the first world governments protecting the rights of real estate. You have, you know, income producing. I'm curious, how much interest are you getting? Can you get on Bitcoin? I've never really dived into that.
It depends on which provider, obviously, you're working with. I would say that I think the highest I've seen around Bitcoin is like maybe 6%.
6%,
right?
So like, really?
So like, yeah, like pretty decent. Now, again, they're rehypothecating because they're taking your Bitcoin, they're lending it out, there's risk, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I always tell people, like, go do your research. But also then, like, stable coins have really high. So I've seen stable coins be upwards of, you know, 9%. And again, it's just people want the stability of a dollar, but they want it in this new format and it's quicker to settle, cheaper, all this kind of stuff. So they're willing to borrow it kind of overnight and things like that at very high rates of return. So it's pretty interesting.
Yeah. So it's just, I guess, and again, to your point of people tend to see things in black and white and not assess probabilities. Like, I think I appreciate your angle where there are different possibilities and probabilities out there. And it's hard to sometimes parse through the Bitcoin like research and arguments because so many of the people are like, it's 100%. Or 99% guaranteed. This is what's going to happen with Bitcoin.
They feel like part of the of the advantage or the offense of Bitcoin is the defense, right? It's hey, if we all lock arms and we stand here, it doesn't matter who runs at us. Like as long as we're together, right? Uh-huh. And we just keep saying the same thing, like we can defeat anybody. And by the way, like I actually think there's like a strong argument for that, right? In terms of like this, like. If you want to establish the next global reserve currency and it's a decentralized currency, like you got to be somewhat ruthless and kind of there's got to be a different bent, right? You can't walk in and negotiate with people and all that kind of stuff. At the same time, I think what you know you're more interested in is having a conversation and a debate around like the investment case, the store of value case, the currency case. Like you have to be a little bit more malleable, I think, in your thought process. And the other piece too that is so important is like. You and I can talk today, and if we come back in 3 years and a bunch of information's changed, you may be the Bitcoin bull and I could be the Bitcoin bear, right?
Exactly,
I think you and I both, like we reserve our right to change our minds as new information comes out. And like I've literally seen, usually it's the bear becomes a bull. In very few cases have I seen a bull become a bear, but there have been a couple. And to me, like that's just so interesting, right? Of like, that's what's fascinating to me, I think, about this asset and so many people is like, today we've talked about technology and innovation. We've talked about literally network effects. We've talked about economics. We've talked about, you know, geopolitical risk. You go through all of this stuff and you're like, and we've only been talking about Bitcoin. Like it's one thing that touches all of these. And so people who just generally, I think, enjoy various topics and call it kind of more like polymathic type thinking, this is, you know, this is like porn to them, right? They're like, oh my God, this is the most amazing thing in the world to talk about.
I totally get it. Because it touches, it's not just an investment. It's not just a trading vehicle. It's not just money. It's like, there's a lot of historical things, freedom and rights, and also some philosophical issues too. I mean, it's like, in a way, it reminds me a little bit of like what Elon Musk is doing with like Mars and AI, trying to save humanity in a sense from its own type of technology in some ways and where it's come to. And so Bitcoin, in a way, offers that kind of possibility. Like, can Bitcoin save, right, the world, the economic system, et cetera, people's money or assets? Like, can technology save, you know, kind of humans from a system where technology is kind of like breaking it down? And so, I mean, I kind of get that. And like, I actually appreciate that from the Bitcoin bulls, like that religious fervor. It's like, yeah, you know, some people like discount it and stuff, but it's because there's something like deeper that resonates with Bitcoin. And I think it's to me, it's like one of the most important trends we need to look out for, you know, in coming years. And actually, I think your approach of keeping up to date, like constantly focused on, if you have, you know, a big portion on it, is the way to go, because things can change, you know, in 6 months, things can be different and you'll be on the forefront understanding the differences, right? Versus some people who are just like kind of 100% like Bitcoin is for sure, you know, the next $100 trillion asset.
18 months ago, it was at like $3,000 or $4,000.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, is that right? No, I'm sorry. Yeah. January of 2019, it was like around, it's a little more than 18 months. It was around like $3,500,
$4,000. Yeah. Yeah.
Today's at 15,000, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
A lot can change.
Yeah. A lot can change. Definitely. But I feel like, yeah, just keeping up to date, like with a fast moving area like Bitcoin, to me is like probably the most prudent thing. But anyways, yeah, I appreciate your time. I'm super helpful. Like, I'm having a hard time finding like a lot of in-depth kind of thinkers to address my concerns.
I'll send you a bunch
of
names.
Can you like, yeah, recommend some stuff?
They're out there.
Okay, yeah. Please recommend some stuff. I'm actually more than eager to do my share of research. I've you know, covered a lot of different people out there. It's just that some of these specific issues, I don't feel that they've dived in deep enough with, you know, especially—
You're asking questions they don't want to talk about.
Perhaps, yeah. Yeah, maybe.
Like you're asking them to explain what happens in the bear case, and
exactly,
you know, when the price is going up and you've got, you know, kind of this deep-seated belief that's sometimes uncomfortable. So
yeah,
you know, it's there's a lot of people who I think are really, really great and great kind of independent thinkers, and mm-hmm. And would love to talk to you. So I'll definitely say some names.
Okay, thanks, Pop. Okay, thanks for the time again. Appreciate it.
Awesome. All right, Dave. Thank you so much.
Okay, take care. We'll see you.
All right, bye.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation. I personally had a fun time getting to know Pomp and discussing Bitcoin. I've had a difficult time finding well-thought-out and articulate cases examining some of the risks for Bitcoin long-term, so I hope this video was helpful. One of the great things about investing is that things are always changing, so there's opportunity for those who are relentless seekers. Our world is changing in radical ways and so quickly, and I'm always trying to get more clarity and understanding on where things are headed. I'd love to hear from you on who you'd like me to interview next. Please add your suggestions in the comments section. Also, I want to hear your thoughts on Bitcoin. What do you see as the risks and challenges ahead, and can Bitcoin overcome them? And if this video has been helpful, please like it. And I've also got some interesting interviews coming up, so consider subscribing to keep notified. On this channel, we're looking at investment topics in the world from different angles, always trying to get beneath the surface of things. I'm on Twitter at HeyDave7, and we'll see you in my next video. Thanks.